You have been listening to the Italian Hour with Andreas Casso on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. And I'm about to sign off. Hope you come back in 2 weeks for another hour of Italian music. I'm going to sign off with Pink Martini, Una Notte a Napoli. And before I go, mention all the announcements and events that are coming up. You can read about them on groups.io/g/Italian Hour. Ciao a tutti e buona domenica.
Una notte a Napoli, con la luna e il mare, ho incontrato un angelo che non poteva più volare. Una notte a Napoli, delle stelle si scordò, e anche senza ali in cielo mi portò.
Con lui volando lontano dalla terra, dimenticando le tristezze della sera, in paradiso oltre le nuvole, pazza d'amore.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
It's 10 a.m. and you're listening to the Jewish Hour on KBOO Portland.
Traveler in third class. Ich bin ein Reisender, dritte Klasse. Mein Name ist Sholem Aleichem. Sagen Sie, frequent mir dem Reisender dritte Klasse. The thing I've seen and in between 11 months of the year on the road with you, my dear. Girls in white, men in black, dogs and cats, brass and tack, golden teeth, crooked track. Then I take the train right back. Traveler in third class. Ich bin ein Reisender, dritte Klasse. Mein Name ist Sholem Aleichem. Sanjute, frag mit mir dem Reisender, dritte Klasse. Through fields of grain in snow and rain, 11 months of the year in the train across Ukraine. Girls in black, men in white, children yell, women fight, golden dreams, dimming light. Then I take the train all night. Sholem Aleichem. Is this he taken? You may ask of the traveler in third class. Ich bin ein Reisender, dritte Klasse. Mein Name ist Hello, how are you? Sanja de frag mit mir dem Reisender, dritte Klasse. The things I've seen and in between 11 months of the year on the road with you, my dear. Through fields of grain and snow and rain, 11 months of the year in the train across Ukraine. In the train across Ukraine, in the train across Ukraine.
Good morgen, boker tov, buenos dias, good morning, and thanks for joining me today on the Portland Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Liz Schwartz. It's the first Jewish Hour of the month of August 2020, and today we have a whole bunch of wonderful stories performed live in studio and in a wonderful field recording by members of the Jewish Theater Collaborative. Enjoy. Good morning, Boker Tov. Good morning, Chag Sameach, and thanks for tuning in to this very special edition of the Yiddish Hour. I'm your host, Liz Schwartz. I hope you've got a comfy chair and a hot cup of coffee nearby, because you're not going to want to miss a single minute of today's show. We're featuring stories from the Jewish Theater Collaborative production, Happy Hour with Shalom Aleichem, a storytelling and klezmer-rocking celebration of our greatest Yiddish storyteller. Joining me in the studio is Sasha Reich.
Good morning.
There we go. Sasha is the director and founder of the Jewish Theater Collaborative. She'll be reading a Sukkot story for us a little bit later on. But right now, let's begin the first story, Progress in Kasarevka.
There sprang up in modern Kasarevka new and forward-looking clubs, organizations, if you will, societies for art, language, and culture. We could just throw a passing glance at these groups, of which there were two of each in the new Kasarevka. For instance, concerning language, there was a group of Yiddishists and a group of Hebraists. Now, the one could not bear the sight of the other, nor stand the mention of the other's name. There was the choral society, Ha-Zamir, which had broken into two groups. One called themselves the flute, and the other the trumpet. And they were at daggers with each other, quite ready to eliminate each other. And then there were two progressive schools, aggressive, really, each with murder in its eye. And then the two Yiddish theaters. And if not for fear of God and the Tsar, they'd have burned each other's buildings down to the ground one night. There were two publishing houses, each ready to swallow its rival, boots and all. And moreover, there existed two literary clubs, two dramatic societies, two emigrant societies, many other sorts of groups. It was really two of each. It was all for the sake of the village's old plague, unbridled competition. It was just impossible to stamp out this ancient Kasarevka heritage. If one fine morning a person cut the nose off his face, by the next day there would be two noseless persons in town. You can bet your life. Does that make any sense, you say? Well, of course it does. If it pays him to cut off his nose, it will pay me to do so also. And just as there were two of everything in Kasarevka, there were two Yiddish newspapers.
The skull cap
and the bowler hat.
Naturally, the skull cap was the traditional, old-fashioned daily for the Orthodox.
And the bowler hat was the modern radical gazette of the progressive elements.
And even the mottos of these two competing papers served quick notice of their policies.
In large letters, the skull cap devoted itself to God and the public.
The editor of the bowler hat placed his own name in equally large print and boldly asserted, "I'm here, it's all here."
When were these two organs founded? Which is the oldest? Now, that's hard to say, because each one proclaimed himself
the oldest
and
the only Yiddish paper
in Kasarevka, and ignored, disregarded, and never so much as mentioned, God forbid, the other's name. But if there was no choice, and one had to denounce, defame, and damn the other,
then the skullcap would call its rival the battered bowler hat.
And the bowler hat would call its opponent the moldy numb skullcap.
For the most part, though, they approached the problem undercover, avoiding the mention of their competitor's name. For example, let us say the bowler hat wanted to talk about its neighbor without printing its name. Instead of saying skullcap, it would think up an alphabetic acrostic like this.
that asinine, beggarly, drunken, envious, feeble, galling, hair-splitting, idiotic, jagged, knee-bending, leprous, mangy, nefarious, ossified, provocating, querulous, rabble-rousing, skimpy, tottering, ugly, venomous, wayward, xenophobic, yellowing, zigzagging rag, whose name we don't even want to mention.
That was a grand success in Keserilivki, and the copies sold like hotcakes. Everyone repeated this Aleph Beis until he had it memorized.
Ot der Evjoin, der Batlin, der Gruberjung, der Dolphin, der Hund, der Witzit Kosra, der Zoylil Vesivanik, der Chotzef, der Tintler, der Yudlak, der Kelev Shabaklovim, der Leidegeyer, der Moser, der Nudnik, der Swolaj, der Amoretz, der Provokator, der Foylak, der Tsuras, der Captain, der Rete, der Scheute, der Terach.
Naturally, this stung the skullcap to the quick, and it came out with its alphabetic answer the next morning.
We have read the Aleph Beis of that ass, bastard, coward, dunce, eel, fool, garbage peddler, hound dog, inquisitor, jellyfish, knave, liar, miser, nihilist, ox, pagan, quack, reptile, scandalmonger, terrorist, unmentionable, villain, wastrel, Xerxes, yokel, and zoo of a paper, but we're not answering, for we have no desire to defile our pens.
The Keserilivki reader...
Ot dem Oisvurf, dem Bodjung, dem Ganef, dem Dovracher, dem Hultai, dem Vovkelake, dem Julik, dem Chazer, dem Trefniak, dem Jungaj, dem Kolbeinik, dem Ligner, dem Mamzer, dem Nachal, dem Skandalist, dem Azazbunen, dem Parch, dem Zörer HaYehudim, dem Krecher, dem Roshe, dem Terach Zenikel.
The Keserilivki reader prefers just this sort of literature more than anything. I couldn't believe that I was home. When I got back to the hotel, dawn was beginning to break. I threw open the door to my room, and I was flabbergasted. I saw three queer-looking men, whom I had never seen before, rummaging about with a candle. My bed was upset, my clothes press was open, my little suitcase lay in the middle of the room, and my papers and manuscripts were scattered all over the floor. "What's all this?" I asked. "Who are you? What are you doing here?" I asked the fellow with the red whiskers and a blue wart on his nose.
"Let him see your knife, and he'll tremble in his boots,"
one of the trio said to the red one with the blue wart. Redbeard did not say a word. He just locked the door, stooped down, and pulling a long, sharp knife out of his boot, he waved it back and forth before my face from side to side and up and down like a magician.
"Want to know who we are? We're the town bandits. I was informed by one of the gang."
A swarthy fellow with a cataract in one eye, when he pronounced the word bandits,
"Gazlunam."
His good eye glared furiously, and he gritted his teeth like a murderer.
"Dienge! Davai, dienge!"
exclaimed the third member of the group, a tall man with a hoarse voice. He grabbed hold of my lapel and shook me like a palm branch. "Is it money you want?" I said. "Do you expect to get money from me? Where do I get money? God has spared me from it."
"You're lying,"
the creature with the cataract said to me.
"Better hand over all the money you've got this very minute, else say goodbye to everything. We're giving you 2 minutes to think it over and 1 minute to say your prayers."
To convince me that they were in dead earnest, Redbeard with the wart on his nose stepped up to me again, pumped his knife up and down and swung it to and fro in the manner of a lulav at the Hallel prayers on Sukkot.
"Why do you stand there like dummies? Tie him up. Where's the rope? Let's tie him up."
"Why go to all the trouble?" I spoke up. "Here, take all I've got, my purse and a few rubles in it, and let me go. What do you want with me? I'm a father of children. Kain O'Hara, 4 girls and 2 boys. The youngest isn't a month old." The three bandits talked things over among themselves in their thieves' jargon. counted the few rubles in my purse, and subjected me to the following cross-examination.
Where are you from?
From Yakupitz.
What's your name?
Shalom Aleichem.
Mistaking my name for the customary Yiddish greeting, they returned the compliment by saying, Aleichem Shalom.
Shalom.
Adding, your name, please.
Shalom Aleichem.
Aleichem Shalom.
We're asking you what they call you.
Shalom Aleichem, that's what they call me.
An odd name.
What do you do?
I'm a writer.
We're asking what you do. You're Parnosa.
I am a writer.
So, what do you write? Petitions or documents or denunciations?
I write articles and storybooks for Jewish children.
Ah, in other words, you're a book vendor, an author.
An author.
So what are you doing here?
I've come to see Kasrilivki.
Is that all?
That's all.
No business whatsoever?
None.
And you gone to some expense to come here?
I've gone to some expense, all right.
What good does it do you?
It gives me something to write about.
Write where?
In the papers.
What papers?
Yiddish papers.
Are they Yiddish papers?
What do you suppose?
What do they do with them?
They print them.
Where do they print
them? In Warsaw.
What are they good for?
For reading.
Who reads them?
Jews.
Does anybody pay you for writing?
Naturally.
Now you're talking. What do you get for it? How much do you get for it? How much do you make a week? Do you smoke? Where are your cigarettes?
I took out my cigarette case and passed it around.
Is this silver?
The bandit with the cataract asked me, weighing the cigarette case in his hand.
Silver or base metal?
As base as they make them. Cost 30 kopecks, I replied, as we all lit our cigarettes.
Where's your watch?
The one-eyed chap called to me as he searched all my pockets.
Haven't you got a watch?
I do have a watch, I said, and a good one at that, a gold one. But it's in pawn in Yehupitz.
That's a sin. We could have made good use of it just now. We need a gold watch in the worst way.
Why do you need a gold watch so badly, I inquired.
A gold watch? Why, you can sell a gold watch, he explained, and get good money for it.
May the casket maker take him, the third bandit interfered. A poor beggar, just like us. Good night, the bandit said as they made for the door.
Next time you leave, you had better lock the door and don't depend on miracles from heaven or the honesty of the town's thieves.
Excuse us if we have troubled you.
Not at all, I rejoined. I'm only sorry you found so little. I was about to show them out.
When husky-voiced bandit put his finger to his lips and drawled out, Pasach Shinsha!
At the same time, Redbeard with the wart whipped out his knife and waved it a few times back and forth in front of my face as if to say, if you breathe a word of this, your life is not worth a copper.
If you're just joining us, this is the Jewish Hour on 90.7 FM KBOO in Portland. My name is Liz Schwartz, and we are featuring an hour of stories performed live and in living color. Let's keep going.
There were nine of us in the car, nine Jews, and we needed a tenth for a minyan, a prayer group. In actual fact, there was a tenth person there. We just couldn't make up our minds if he was a Jew or a Christian. An uncommunicative individual with a gold pince-nez, a freckled face, and no beard. A Jewish nose, but an oddly twirled, un-Jewish mustache. Ears that stuck out like a Jew's, but a neck that was red like a goy's. Even from the start, he had kept his distance from us. Most of the time, he just looked out the window and whistled. He was hatless, and a Russian newspaper lay across his knees, and not a word out of him. A genuine Russian. A goy, if ever there was one. No? On second thought, though, how could he be a goy? Who did he think he was fooling? The idea! It takes a Jew to know one. A Jew can smell another Jew a mile off on a moonless night. For goodness sake, God has written it all over us. No, the man was a Jew for sure. I'd stake my life on it. Or was he? These days you can never tell. By the time the nine of us were through conferring in whispers, it was decided that we had seen his type before. What to do, though? If a Jew wanted to pass for a Christian, it was nobody's business but his own. Yet, just then, we needed a tenth man, and needed him badly, because one of us had a Yahrzeit, a death anniversary to observe, and wanted to say Kaddish, the mourner's prayer. And it wasn't any ordinary Yahrzeit, either, the kind we all have for a father or a mother. No, this was the anniversary of the passing of a child, an only son. That's who it was. It had been a struggle, the boy's father told us, just to get the body returned by the prison so that it could be brought to a Jewish grave. And the youngster, he swore, was perfectly innocent. He had been railroaded at his trial. Not that he hadn't been thick with the other revolutionaries, but still, that was no reason to hang him. Hang him they did, though. And his mother died soon after. But not so soon as all that. Oh, no, first she ate her heart out bit by bit and made her husband gray before his time. How old would you say I am? This man asked us. We all looked at him, trying to guess his age. It was impossible. While his eyes were young, his hair was gray. His heavily lined face seemed on the verge of either laughter or tears. There was, in fact, something very strange about his whole appearance. He was wearing a gabardine that was much too long for him. His hat was pushed back on his head, and his beard was an oddly rounded goatee. And those eyes of his, those eyes, they were half laughing, half crying. If only he would unburden himself and let the tears out. But no. He insisted on being the very soul of gaiety, at least on the surface. A most peculiar fellow this morning. Well, now, where are we going to find a tenth man? Asked one of us out loud, with a glance at the passenger with the pince-nez and no hat, who gave no sign of having heard. He simply looked out the window and went on whistling some Russian tune. What do you mean, where? Asked someone else. Don't we have 10 already? And he began to go around the car with his finger, counting. 1, 2, 3. Count me out, said the whistler in Yiddish. You mean you're not a Jew? I am a Jew, he responded. I just don't happen to believe in such things. For a long time, we sat there, dumbfounded, looking at each other without a word. The bereaved father alone did not seem to be put out in the least. With his half-laugh, half-cry of a smile, he said to the whistling young man,
"More power to you. You deserve a gold medal."
"I do? For what?"
"To tell the truth, that's a rather long story. But if you'll agree to be the tenth man for prayers, so that I can say Kaddish for my son, I promise to tell it to you afterwards."
And as the young man by the window nodded, the good-humored mourner took out a large handkerchief from his pocket, twisted it into a belt, girded his waist in the manner of a pious Jew, turned his face to the wall of the car, and began the afternoon prayer. The mourner led us with such feeling, with such soulfulness, that we were all touched to the depths of our heart, even, I dare say, the conscripted tenth man. Listening to a father pray on the occasion of his own son's Yahrzeit is not something that can leave a person cold, especially when the words are chanted in such a sweet, heartfelt voice. They're like a balm to the weary bones. And above all, the Kaddish. The Kaddish! A stone couldn't help but be moved by a Kaddish like that. Having finished praying and removed his makeshift belt, the mourner set himself down opposite our tenth man, and with the same strangely, gaily, tragic expression as before, commenced his promised story. He stroked his little round beard as he told it, speaking slowly, like a man who has time.
"The story I'm going to tell you, young man, is actually not one story, but three. Three little stories in one. The first story happens to an innkeeper who lived with his wife in a large village. There were many Russians in it, but no other Jews. They were the only ones. Not that it troubled them, far from it. It meant that they could earn a good living without fear of competition. Better rich among Christians, as they say, than poor among Jews. In fact, they lacked only one thing: children. For years they had prayed for them in vain and made their life sorrowful. Finally, when they were nearly past childbearing age, the innkeeper's wife conceived and gave birth to a healthy child. And a male child, too. What happiness! Of course, it was necessary to circumcise the boy, and so, on the eighth day, the innkeeper gladly harnessed his horse to his wagon, drove off to the next village, and came back with the rabbi, the beadle, the circumciser, and five other Jews. Naturally, his wife had a magnificent banquet ready for them when they arrived. Everything was fine until the time came for the circumcision, at which point it was discovered they were missing a Jew. There were only nine of them. What had happened? Leave it to a country innkeeper. In counting to ten, he had made the mistake of including his own wife. You can imagine what a good laugh the guests had. Meanwhile, though, the time was passing, and what were they supposed to do now? It was a big village, full of goyim, but nary another Jew. What a predicament! Just then, however, someone looked out the window, and what did he see but a coach heading straight for the inn. In it was sitting a coachman. Well, thought the innkeeper, let it be even a coachman, as long as it was a Jew. "Welcome, stranger," he said to the newcomer. "Shalom aleichem," said the coachman. "A Jew! No words can describe the joy there was. Tell me now, don't we have a God in heaven? A whole village of goyim couldn't save the day. They were almost to the point of allowing a woman to be counted in a minyan when along comes a stranger, a single Jew, and sets everything right. Now, the second story takes place not in a village, but a town, and in a solidly Jewish one, too. It happened on the Sabbath, that is, on a Friday evening after the candles had been lit. A father came home from the synagogue, blessed the wine, washed his hands, and just as he was sitting down to eat with his wife and children, a candle did a very strange thing. Still burning, it collapsed suddenly, broken in two. They tried propping it up with the challah to no avail. The burning candle fell onto the tablecloth and threatened to set it on fire. In another minute, the whole house would be in flames. What were they supposed to do now? Put it out? But it was the Holy Sabbath. The women and girls began to wail, "We'll be ruined!" Just then, however, someone glanced out the window, and who should be coming up the street but Kvetka, the neighbor, a goy. "Kvetka, good man!" they cried out the window, being careful not to overstep the law. "Did you ever see such a strangely burning candle?" And Kvetka, not completely stupid, even though he was a goy, got the point at once. He spat on his hands, pinched the burning wick between two calloused Christian fingers, and poof, the fire was out. I ask you, do we not live in an age of miracles? A whole family of Jews rescued by a single goy. And now, I have to tell you my third story. This one concerns none other than a famous rabbi.
This rabbi had only one son, an exceptionally capable youngster who was all a rabbi's son should be. He was married off when still young, given a handsome dowry, and encouraged to study Torah all day long at his father-in-law's expense. Indeed, that's just what he did. And everything would have been perfect if there hadn't been such a thing as the draft. On the face of it, of course, the boy had nothing to worry about. To begin with, he was an only son. And besides, if it was a problem of money, then money was no problem at all in this case. But the times were bitter. Even only sons were being taken into the army, and 10,000 rubles couldn't buy a boy's way out of it. The authorities were ruthless. I tell you, it was a bad situation. The doctor who did the examinations had a heart of stone. Just imagine, the rabbi's son was stripped to the bone and brought before the doctor. Why, never before in his whole life had he been without a hat on his head. And that's what saved him, because he happened to have a canker there, a real running sore. There was nothing make-believe about it. He must have had it since childhood without knowing it. He was one of those boys who is so stubborn that he refuses to have his hair washed even once. Well, I needn't tell you that once the doctor saw that, he and the draft board sent this boy pecking in a hurry. And now, tell me, my dear young friend, said the mourner to the young man by the window, do you understand your true worth? You were born a Jew, and now you are practicing to be a goy. Already you are a festering, running sore. Don't you think you deserve a gold medal? At the very next station, our tenth man slipped away. We did not see him again.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Jewish Hour with host Liz Schwartz on 90.7 FM KBOO in Portland, 91.9 FM in Hood River, 104.3 FM in Philomath and Corvallis, and all over planet Earth at KBOO.FM. If you'd like to see a playlist of today's show, just go to the Portland Jewish Hour webpage at KBOO.FM/Portland Jewish Hour. You'll also find audio for today's show and our past shows on the Jewish Hour site. You can just scroll down. You'll find it all there. And also with playlists. And you can listen to this show in its entirety at your convenience.
My father was a rabbi in Warsaw. He would hold a Bet Din, a rabbinical court, in our home. It was a blend of a court of law, a house of study, and even a sort of psychoanalyst's office, where people of troubled spirit would come to unburden themselves. He would offer advice, guidance, and counseling. He would settle disputes, providing justice tempered with godliness, and his judgments were accepted with goodwill and with trust in the wisdom of his words and in the divine power behind them. Often, in our home, there was talk about spirits of the dead that possess the bodies of the living, souls reincarnated as animals, houses inhabited by hobgoblins, cellars haunted by demons. My father, a very learned man, spoke of these things first of all because he was interested in them, and second because in a big city children can easily go astray. They go everywhere. See everything. Read profane books. It is necessary to remind them from time to time that there are still mysterious forces at work in the world. One day, he was speaking of these things, of demons crawling around the intestines, slithering in the belly, and how Rabbi Eliyahu of Gridik had exorcised the evil spirits with the blowing of the ram's horn, with incantations and the incense of magic herbs. Suddenly, the door opened, and a woman entered. She was carrying a basket in which there were two geese. The woman looked frightened. Her kerchief was tilted to one side, and she smiled nervously. Father never looked at strange women because it is forbidden by Jewish law. But Mother and I could see immediately that something had greatly upset our unexpected guest.
Rabbi, I have a very unusual problem.
What is it? A woman's problem.
No.
If the answer had been yes, I would have been sent out of the room immediately.
No. It's about these geese.
What is the matter with them?
Oh, dear Rabbi, these geese were slaughtered properly. Then I cut off their heads. I took out the intestines, the livers, all the other organs. But the geese kept shrieking in such a sorrowful voice.
Upon hearing these words, my father turned pale. A dreadful fear befell me, too. But my mother came from a family of rationalists. She was, by her nature and upbringing, a skeptic.
Slaughtered geese don't shriek.
The woman was quite prepared to prove her point. She took one of the geese and placed it on the table. Then she took out the second goose. The geese were headless, disemboweled, in short, ordinary dead geese. A smile appeared on my mother's lips.
These geese shrieked?
The woman took one goose and hurled it against the other. At once, a shriek was heard. It is not easy to describe the sound. It was not exactly like the cackling of a goose. It had a high, eerie pitch, and it had a groaning and quaking about it, such that my limbs grew cold. I could actually feel the hairs of my earlocks pricking me. I wanted to run from the room, but where could I go? My throat constricted with fear. Then I screamed high and thin, and not unlike the geese. And I clung to my mother's skirt like a child of three. Father was no less frightened than I. His red beard trembled. In his eyes could be seen a mixture of fear and vindication. For my father, this was a sign that not only to Rabbi Eliyahu of Gridek, but to him too, omens were sent from heaven. But perhaps this was a sign from the evil one himself.
I do not understand what is going on here.
My mother was no longer smiling. In her eyes there was a question, but also something like anger, and there was a certain resentment in her voice.
I want to hear it again.
Again the woman threw one goose against the other, and again the dead geese gave forth an uncanny shriek, the shriek of a dumb creature slain by the slaughterer's knife, who yet retains a living force, who still has a reckoning to make with the living and injustice to avenge. A chill crept over me.
Rabbi, what should I do? Where shall I go? What a terrible thing has befallen me. What should I do with them? Perhaps I should go to Krakow, to one of the wonder rabbis? Perhaps the geese were not slaughtered properly. I'm afraid to take them home. I wanted to prepare them for the Sabbath meal, and now such a calamity. Holy Rabbi, what should I do? Must I throw them out? Someone said they must be wrapped in shrouds and buried in a grave. I'm a poor woman. Two geese, they cost me a fortune.
Father did not know what to answer. He glanced at his bookcase. If there was an answer to be found, surely it must be there. Then he turned and looked at my mother, as if demanding an explanation.
Let me hear it once more.
Mother's face was growing smaller, sharper. In her eyes there was a fierce concentration, along with indignation that she did not yet understand. Her tone was commanding, and for a third time the woman hurled the geese against one another, and for a third time the shrieks were heard. It occurred to me that such must have been the voice of the sacrificial heifer.
And what do you say now, eh?
Woe, and still they blaspheme. They behold the truth with their own eyes, and they continue to deny their maker. They are dragged into the bottomless pit, and yet they maintain that all is nature, all is accident. You take after them.
There was something in my mother's laughter that made us all tremble. I knew by some sixth sense that mother was preparing to end the mighty drama that had been enacted before our eyes.
Did you remove the windpipes?
There was a pause, a silence, during which we all looked at the dead geese on my father's table as if they would answer for themselves.
Take them out. Take out the windpipes, and the geese will stop shrieking.
For a long moment, nobody moved. Then Mother took hold of one of the geese, pushed her slender finger into the body, and with all her might pulled out the thin tube that led from the neck to the lungs. Then she took the other goose and removed its windpipe also. I stood trembling, aghast at my mother's courage. Her hands had become bloodied. On her face could be seen the righteous wrath of a rationalist whom someone has tried to frighten in broad daylight. Father's face turned white, calm, a little disappointed. He knew what had happened here. Logic, cold logic, was again tearing down faith, mocking it, holding it up to ridicule and scorn.
Now, if you please, take one goose and hurl it against the other.
Everything hung in the balance. If the geese shrieked, Mother would have lost all. Her rationalist's daring, her skepticism which she had inherited from her intellectual father. And I, although I was afraid, I prayed inwardly that the geese would shriek. Shriek so loud that people in the street would hear and come running. But alas, the geese were silent. As only two dead geese with no windpipes can be silent. Mother turned to me.
Bring me a towel.
I ran to get the towel. There were tears in my eyes. Mother wiped her hands on the towel like a surgeon after an operation.
That's all it was.
Father began to cough, to mumble. He fanned himself with a sheet of paper and moved his skullcap on the back of his head. His face betrayed his thinking. He had never heard of such a thing.
There is always an explanation. Dead geese don't shriek. You go home, cook them for Sabbath. Don't be afraid. They won't make a sound in your pot.
Father could only look up and nod. He was not really convinced, but he could not pronounce the geese unclean.
I'm going back to the kitchen. You stay here with your father.
Your mother takes after your grandfather, the rabbi of Bilgure. He is a great scholar, but he is a cold-blooded rationalist. He has no sense of the miraculous. People warned me before we were married. But now, what can I do?
As I walked through the village, I looked for at least one of the old clubs. I remember there used to be clubs to the point of excess here. And I'm not talking about the Psalms and the Mishnah clubs. I mean societies like the Free Loan, the Free Kitchen, the Visit the Sick, the Clothe the Poor, the Help the Needy, the Medical Aid, the Relieve the Oppressed. It seemed that all these groups had gone the way of their founders. They passed on, like most of the little people. Like lonely old Reb Cantor Melech, may the fruits of Gan Eden be his. Thinking of him brought tears to my eyes. He was someone to envy. In all of Kesrilivke's history, there was no finer funeral than that of Reb Melech the Cantor. Reb Melech was a pauper, just like all the poorest of the poor, just like all the rest of Kesrilivke. He received the funeral he did only because he died during the closing evening prayer, the Yom Kippur service, and only the saintly die in this manner. The sun was about to set. It was bidding goodbye to Kesrilivke, shining straight through the old synagogue, lighting up the dead, worn faces, the yellow prayer shawls, the men's robes, which made them look like living corpses. These live corpses had long ceased to feel the sensation known as hunger. They just felt their life strength ebbing away. They sat over their prayer book, they swang, refreshing themselves with a pinch of snuff or smelling salts of ammonia, and singing along with the chazan. Now, Reb Melech the Cantor was a handsome, long bearded, thick necked man, and he'd been standing on his feet since early that morning. He stood before the Rabbana Shalom with arms outstretched, praying devotedly, crying and pleading for mercy for the people who had chosen him to beg forgiveness for their great sins and ask that they be inscribed for a year of health and peace. The people in the synagogue could well depend on Reb Melech as their intercessor. First of all, his voice. The townspeople said that in his youth, Reb Melech had a voice as clear and sharp and strong as a lion's roar. When he opened his mouth, the walls trembled and the windows shook. As of late, he had become a weeper. He cried as he sang like a weeping willow, and looking at him, the whole congregation would burst into tears too. As he grew older, his voice became rusty, and only the weeping remained. But it was the sort of weeping that could move a wall or wake the dead. Reb Melech lifted his hands, arguing with the Rabbana Shalom in the age-old plaintive melody of the final Yom Kippur prayer. Hearing this, each person regretted his sins and prayed to God to erase, blot out, forget, and forgive all their transgressions and grant them and their naked, barefoot, hungry children a good year. Having reminded themselves of their naked, barefoot, and hungry children, the poor innocent souls, their hearts melted like wax, and they were ready to fast for 3 more days, so long as the Eternal One would grant them a year of health. Meanwhile, Reb Melech rested and caught his breath. Now he cleared his throat, and he sang a while in his old tremolo, and then resumed his plaintive cry. Suddenly there was a silence, and the sound of a thump, and a fall was heard, and everyone crowded forward, whispering, Shabbos! Chaim the Shamas ran over and he lifted the canter, but Reb Melech's head hung down, his eyes half open, his face as white as chalk, his lips ashen. A bitter smile played on his ashen lips, and the whole congregation pressed forward. They put spirits of ammonia under his nose. They sprinkled water on his face. They pressed his temples. But it was no use. Reb Melech was dead. When a wolf attacks the flock and kills a lamb, the rest of the lambs panic. They press together and they begin to tremble all over. They panic in a group, and that's what happened in the old synagogue when Reb Melech died. First, a tumult broke out. An eerie scream was heard from the women's section. Tzvia, the cantor's wife, had fainted, and looking at her, the other women fainted too. Reb Yosefel, the village rabbi, he gave a wink to the gabayim, and they banged on the prayer stands for silence. Chaim the Shamas, who had led the morning service, went up to the pulpit and continued praying. The whole congregation prayed until Reb Nissel blew the shofar, which officially brought Yom Kippur to a close. They immediately started the weekday evening service. Then they went home to break the fast. An hour after supper, the entire synagogue courtyard was packed. Packed with people. There was no room to breathe. Men and women, boys and girls, even babies had gathered for the funeral. The villagers themselves took care of the details, not allowing the shamoshin the privilege. And it was no trifle. The cantor was a very important person. The night was bright and warm.
shown down on Kazrilivki, delighted with the poor people who had come to pay their last respects to Reb Melech the cantor before he took his long last journey. Reb Yosefel began his funeral oration, and all the people cried.
Reb Yosefel quoted the Pusukim and the Midrashim and showed that Reb Melech the cantor's death was not that of an ordinary mortal. Only saintly, very saintly men die that way. Such saints went straight to paradise. Everyone ought to envy a man as saintly as he. For not all were worthy of dying at the pulpit during the closing Yom Kippur prayer, when God has forgiven all of man's sins. When a man as saintly as he is laid to rest, the entire village must accompany him. When a man as saintly as he dies, the entire village must cry and mourn. Cry then, fellow Jews. Mourn this saintly man whom we have lost. Beg him to be a worthy advocate for us before the Kisei HaKavod. Perhaps he will pray that we all have a good year, a year of peace and health. For it is high time that God had mercy on Kesrelivka and its Jews.
Everyone wept. Tears streamed from their eyes, and they felt they had sent a fine emissary to the Almighty on their behalf. At that moment, each person wished he were in Reb Melech's shoes. It seemed that Reb Yosefel forgot that he was addressing a corpse. And he finished his funeral oration with these words.
Well then, lech leshalom, go in peace. Ge gesundheit, go in good health. And lots of good luck to you.
And for a long time thereafter, the Kesrelivki folk talked about Reb Melech the cantor's funeral, the fine funeral. Mentioning it, they sighed. Ah, yes. He was someone to envy.
No matter how bad things get, you got to go on living, even if it kills you. Shalom Aleichem.
La Miralein Meinem Enainem Mark Loring Mekabel Punim Zain Mark Loring Mekabel Punim Zain La Miralein Enem La Miralein Enem Trinken a Gläser Levein La Miralein Enem La Miralein Enem Trinken a Flesche Lebeer.
Life is a dream for the wise, a game for the fool, a comedy for the rich, and a tragedy for the poor. Shalom Aleichem.
La mirale inanim inanim semauri mekabel punim zain semauri mekabel punim zain la mirale inanim la mirale inanim trinken a glaze levain la mirale inanim la mirale inanim trinken a flesh le beer.
Life is a blister on top of a tumor and a boil on top of that.
La mirale inanim inanim George Lederer mekabel punim zain George mekabel punim zain La mirale inanim La mirale inanim Trinken a glaze levain Glomerallinanum, drinking a flesh of the beer.
From time immemorial, we Jews have loved music and have understood what it really is. There is nothing in the world to compare to such pleasure, and when it does come to us in once in a while, we do not fail to appreciate it. Shalom Aleichem.
La mera la inanim and anim Sasha Reich mekabel punim zayn. Wendy Wilcox mekabel punim zayn.
Jack Paul.
La mera la inanim, la mera la inanim, trinkin a glazer levine. Courtney Bondrelli. La mera la inanim, la mera la inanim, trinkin a flesh a beer.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO